Indie Prime, yes, Indie Prime, on Indie Live Radio. Indie Prime, yes, Indie Prime, on Indie Live Radio.
So on behalf of the Dunbartonshire CA, my name is Lydia, and I would like to thank you for coming this afternoon and welcome you to our local church hall. And we're delighted to have this afternoon Ruth Watson, who I think basically took it upon herself to start the Keep Scotland Alive campaign, where she realised that everything was becoming covered in Union Jacks a few years ago. And I know, Ruth, that you've been down to the Houses of Parliament and given evidence to the Select Committee, and you're also running the campaign very successfully in Scotland. And we're delighted to have you here to listen to and hopefully ask questions of later. So, ladies and gentlemen, Ruth Watson.
Thank you all very much for coming along today. My name's Ruth Watson, and I started the Keep Scotland the Brand campaign after I went to buy some carrots. And being a good Scottish mammy, I thought I'd go and make some carrot coriander soup, because it's one of the few things that my children won't complain about. So I went down to the shops to buy my carrots, and the local croupy, I walked in, and the week before, the carrots that I bought had just been carrots from Angus, and I knew the field that they came from, because where I live, I'm lucky enough to live in a beautiful part of Scotland, Kirriemuir, and I look across the Angus strath of Strathmore, where the beautiful black soil is perfect for root vegetables. So these Angus carrots previously had just been Angus carrots from this particular farm. But this day, I looked and my hands just stayed quivering above these carrots, because there was something new. These carrots were no longer just carrots. They were no longer carrots from a farm in Angus. They were no longer Scottish carrots. These carrots now were emblazoned with a flag and were crying themselves as Great British carrots. And I thought, this is really weird, because I know that clear provenance is good for sales. I know that Scotland's reputation as an agricultural centre is unrivaled. And I also understand a bit about branding and how important clear brands are. But then I looked around me, and it was kind of like that moment. I don't know if you've ever seen The Matrix, but you know, I had a Keanu Reeves moment. And I looked around me and I thought, Jims, I realised that I was surrounded by more flags than one might reasonably expect to find at a Jubilee street party. And I thought, this is new. And it concerned me, because many years ago, I was lucky enough to work as a journalist. I was a reporter for the BBC up in Orkney and Shetland. And I spent I was a freelance, but I did a lot of work for them. And I was lucky enough to spend time dealing with a lot of agricultural and fisheries issues. So I get very dewy-eyed if you start talking to me about diamond mesh and square mesh netting and pelagic fleet. Because in all those years, watching Scotland's reputation grow on the world stage, watching Scotland's reputation in particular as a provider of quality food and drink, I knew that Scotland's name for quality sells around the world, and it sells at home too. And so I thought, why? Why would something that is such a selling point suddenly have its labelling change? Because this is not an issue about flag waving. It is not an issue about them versus us. It's an issue of our economy. It's an economic. I mean, you wouldn't get a particular brand of burger going up to another brand of burger and saying, "See, they golden arches. They're working fine. But what we're going to do is stick a crown on them. Don't worry about it. Oh, by the way, we're going to change the name as well. Something with king in it. Is that okay?" It wouldn't happen, because you'd have the lawyers on instantly, because brands matter. All the evidence shows that when a shopper enters a supermarket, if they're like me, and most are, it's kind of like a supermarket dash. You want to get in, you want to get out of the fluorescent hell that is before you, so you can go back and throw some food in front of ungrateful children. And you have 6 seconds when a shopper enters an aisle. The research shows you have got 6 seconds to get your product from the shelf into the basket. Now, people like me who are passionate about Scottish butter, I get really nerdy about a lot of stuff. And Scottish butter is one of the top in the world. It's one of the top in the world for the same reason why our Scotch beef is amongst the best in the world. It's because our cattle wander about eating grass. They do the stuff that cows are supposed to do. They swish their tails, they raise their horns, they eat the grass, and they just munch about the place being happy in a pretty good environment, being cared for by farmers who, generally speaking, work really, really hard at animal welfare. And all of that results in healthy animals producing healthy food. Breads, butters, just cheeses, food that you can rely on. So when I go, for example, to buy Scottish butter, because I want to buy Scottish butter because it tastes so good, I actually bought a pat from my local dairy the other day, coming from local cows, and it is just stupendous, the flavour. I have a friend visiting from Malaysia, and she had some bread and butter, and actually the bread was baked by an artisan baker in Perth, and the butter came from the udders of a cow 7 miles away, and she tasted this, and she was, oh my goodness, this is amazing. She, staying the night, was, had come down for a snack and looking for something a bit fancy. And I went, would you like some bread and butter? And she sort of looked at me like I was odd. Why would anybody eat bread and butter? But I gave her this local bread and this local butter. And she ended up having a couple more slices. And then she said, is there cinnamon in this? I went, nope. Just, because she was getting flavours coming through that she hadn't experienced from bread and butter before. Now, why, if you can produce something like that from a local farm, nothing fancy, it's just butter, why would you hide that from the world? So I used to buy own brand butter all the time, because all the supermarkets used to do own brand Scottish butter. And it was about October last year, I went again to buy some product, and I went, where's the Scottish butter gone? It's British butter, where's the Scottish butter gone? And it will not surprise you to know that I'm on first name terms with many of the managers in my local supermarkets. And this lad, he went, well, it should be Scottish butter. I said, I can, it should be Scottish butter. Where's it gone? And he looked, and he went and he sort of did the sort of Wilco Wilco 1212 in his ear, and he said, it's British butter now. I'll take that label off, because it was labelled as Scottish butter, still on the shelf. That's how new it was. And the explanations come back thick and fast when you write to supermarkets. They say, oh, well, we're no longer designating Scottish milk and Scottish butter separately. It's all going into a communal vat. And so we couldn't possibly tell you where the milk's coming from to make the butter. But I've spoken to people in the dairy industry. The wonderful thing about Scotland's Farm Assured Scheme, which incidentally is the first Farm Assured Scheme in the world, and I contend is the best, regardless of what some people with brightly coloured tractors might say, Scotland's Farm Assured Scheme is the best because it is from birth through life and into death that the life cycle of this animal is charted. And the barcode they've got on their ear, which identifies them. That means that when a cow goes to get milked and they kind of go past the barcode, the systems in place are so sophisticated that if you've got a mixed herd of Guernseys and Jerseys and Frisians, if you so chose, then you could have the piping going so that the Guernsey milk went to one vat, the Jersey milk went to another vat, and the Frisian milk went to another vat. So if you wished, you could have a mixed herd giving you the butter that you wanted to have. Now that means that it is perfectly possible still to have Scottish butter as Scottish butter. And there are, of course, people like Scottish Pride and Graham's who do a terrific job. I mean, Graham's milk, Graham's dairies have, I credit them with practically single-handedly saving the dairy industry in the northeast of Scotland, because they have made marketable, they have sort of, since the demise of the Milk Marketing Board, they have helped support and keep the identity of northeast farmers, keep farming viable. And there are many reasons why this matters. One of them, obviously, is food security. The first duty of any government is to feed its people. And so when I was doing a panel one day with somebody from the National Farmers Union up in Angus, and he said, he's an arable farmer, and he said, well, if he said, of course, DEFRA, that's the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, they are looking at the future of farming, and they are actually looking at letting sectors of farming fail because it is cheaper to import than to support. They're looking at outsourcing arable to the Ukraine. And there was a collective sigh of horror from the audience before us, because in that audience was a gentleman who later came up to me and he said, there have been people farming on my land for 4,500 years. I have the archaeological evidence in my backyard to prove it. And I do not want to be the last. I was chatting to some guys at the Kerry show, in fact, who I also saw up at the Black Isle show. And you know, I kind of was kind of wandering around, hello, what a leaflet. And they were like, ah, really, you're just scaremongering. And I said to him what I had been told, and actually what research I have done later since shows that it is indeed something that is being considered. And I said to them, and what do you think is going to happen to the sale of your 200,000-300,000 pound behemoths that you see trundling up and down the fields? What do you think is going to happen to your sales of combine harvesters if we outsource arable to the Ukraine? And that was the point at which they started having a conversation with me about the importance of Scotland's brand and about why it is we should be looking at sustainability and food security. Because it was a couple of years ago now, but the beast from the east, when it came, I don't know what it was like down here, but in Kerry it was, there was a lot of snow. And my supermarket, my little local Co-op, looked like the zombie apocalypse had hit. There wasn't, I mean, people were buying stuff that, I mean, yes. Cup, you know, cake in a mug, we're going to buy that because there's nothing to eat for weeks to come. People were really concerned. And it took a long time. It was 3 weeks before the food came back to our shelves. Now, it's my husband, who is a fabulous and compassionate man. He's very patient, as you can imagine, being married to me. He's a patient man. And he made the observation that Kim Jong-un could have sailed up the Forth. As long as he had a pallet of bread and some pints of milk, he'd have been handed the keys to Holyrood, because a hungry people is a vulnerable people. And as I've said many times before, having weapons of mass destruction up the Clyde is not going to protect us from anything. You don't need people threatening us with nuclear weapons back. If we have no food security, you don't need nuclear weapons. You need somebody with a clipboard and a couple more bits of paper going, oh, sorry, this delivery is going to be a wee bit late. Hope you folk don't need bread for a week or two. That is real security. Feeding yourself is real security. Having food and drink on farms nearby that can get to a local population. And in Scotland, we're really lucky because the majority of people are never more than 12 miles from a farm. That's food security. If you stop farming land, or if you sell it off for housing, if you stop farming land, within 6 years, the microbiome within that soil has stopped being productive for farming. You have to start again. You have to start working on it again. So losing prime arable is a big issue. And in Scotland, one of the reasons why it is policy for the National Farmers Union that powers, after Brexit, that powers of agriculture come back to Holyrood. That is the National Farmers Union policy, because farmers around Scotland recognise that our situation is very different from that which DEFRA looks at in England. In Scotland, 87% of our land is called least favoured area status. That means it's the kind of thing that grows heather and that you sort of need to be a bit of a goat to kind of, like, you know, jump up and down and get a livelihood of. Highland cows, love it. Wheat, not so much. So 13% of the land that we have in Scotland is of the kind that will grow crops and whether it be barley or turnips. 13%. In England, it's actually almost completely opposite. I think it's 85% is high quality arable and 13% is less favoured, 15% is less favoured area status, which is, you're talking about Yorkshire and the hills, the kind of sort of moor kind of areas. But that means that the priorities that DEFRA has, the understanding that DEFRA have about farming is very different. It also, given that that farming in England now is much more sort of industrialised, there's much more of your hedge fund managers and have sort of bought into farming, so it's much less likely to be a family that owns it. It's more likely to be like a business or a conglomerate, corporate farming. And they have different pressures on them and tend to go for a different style of farming. In Scotland, if memory serves, I think it is 40% or maybe 56%, if I remember my stats right, there's one of them, are predominantly family-owned farms. And the average household income, now there's a guy called Jim Fairley who is brilliant. Jim knows farming in a really intricate way. He's really good with his facts and his stats. And every time I say this, he goes, Ruth, no, you've got to stop saying this stat, because there's no farmer I know earning that kind of money. But it is a statistic which the National Farmers Union has released as being an accurate statistic, and that is that the average household farming, average household income from farming is £26,400. Now, bear in mind that's an average. You're talking about the Duke of Buccleuch at one end and somebody with three cows at the other. So I agree with Jim, it probably is less, but that is a figure. But even with that figure, that is not a lot of money in farming. We're not looking at farmers always being people who are sort of driving around in Range Rovers, don't have a clue of the pressures of life. Most farmers work really, really hard for very little income to make sure that quality food gets onto our plates. So why is this sort of great British branding happening when Scotland has got this terrific product? In 2011, David Cameron had an idea. Now, the ideas from David Cameron go, this was not the worst he's ever had. Hey, we win. So he decided that with the Olympics coming, he would kind of buy into this cool Britannia, you know, like Spice Girls and double-decker buses and Boris Johnson up a zip wire. And so he came up with the whole thing, sort of like, Britain is great. And that actually is a pretty good branding exercise. I do think that he was onto something with it. DEFRA then, he was roundly mocked in the Telegraph for it. And DEFRA didn't do so much about it, but the Department for International Trade sort of went with it a bit. So, you know, sort of castles are great. And then something in 2014 must have happened to make them think that they would resurrect it, and resurrect it they did. And so the Department for International Trade started putting forward, like, the Kelpies are great, you know, just sort of throwing out more and more products which might be good for London, but wouldn't be particularly helpful for Scotland, because as a marketing strategy, and I can tell this from personal experience, when you are overseas, I lived in Malaysia for many years, and if I said to people I was British, they'd go, oh, London. And no, Scottish. And they'd go, oh, and they'd look at me, and this dates me a little, they would smile and they'd say, Braveheart. And now, of course, it would be Jamie. They would have visions of Jamie sort of floating through the heather and get a bit dewy-eyed about it. But that is... in that one kind of exchange, which was repeated many, many times when I was in Malaysia, it made me realise then that how interchangeable and how much of an issue this must be for people across England as well. If you say Britain, people think London. It must be very hard to build a brand that is an English brand which relies on people recognising England as being more than just the London Eye. So occasionally I get a cheesemonger. There's a cheesemonger in Cornwall who occasionally contacts me because he's deeply concerned about the Great British Campaign, because it is losing his Cornish brand. The farmers in Kentish strawberries, first time I ever had Kentish strawberries, true story, was at the Wimbledon's men's finals, and I had my first pins and I had Kentish strawberries and they were awesome. And your Norfolk asparagus, and there are places around England, Wales, Ireland and Scotland, which have got tremendous local provenance and really good reputations. And those brands are hard fought and hard won. And when at the Common Select Committee, James Withers, the CEO of Scotland Food and Drink, and Johnny Hall of the National Farmers Union, when they were asked what they thought about the Great British Campaign and how effective it was, one of them said, it rides roughshod over the work that we have done for developing Scotland's brand. Because Scotland's brand is an international success story. People look at Scotland's brand and go, wow, you guys have done tremendously. 1 in 5 people in Scotland are employed in a food and drink related sector in some way, whether it be a lorry driving the food and drink to somewhere, somebody making a sandwich to sell to somebody else, food and drink tourism, or farmers, or beekeepers, as we have in our midst now. Food and drink employs, in some way or another, 1 in 5 adults in Scotland, and they're looking for that to be 1 in 4 by 2030. That's a phenomenal boost. And when you think that back in the days of BSE, when suddenly people thought feeding cows to their grannies, to their granddaughters, and rather than feeding just grass, as we like to do in Scotland, the rendering industry went a bit nuts. They decided because the price of fuel was so high, they asked for permission to reduce the temperatures at which produce was rendered, and then the feed that they were, the dead animals that they were putting into the feed to feed to vegetarian animals, suddenly, surprise, surprise, it turns out that's not a good idea, and BSE came onto the scene, and overnight was threatened to destroy Scotland's beef industry. Overnight, farmers started going out of business. The pug was pulled, understandably, by countries going, we don't want any of that. So some farmers got together and they decided on, how are we going to do this? How do we get confidence back into the system? And they came up with a farm-assured scheme, which meant that people would know exactly the provenance of the food they were getting. And it was within 6 months, I think every slaughterhouse and butcher had signed up to it, if memory serves, and most of the farmers across Scotland, to the point now that there are very, very few. It tends to be smallholders who just want to have a sheep for their own use or a cow to keep them through the year that aren't using the farm assured scheme. That is phenomenal. And with that came an international interest. People started looking at what Scotland had to offer. And then the campaign, Scotland the Brand, came in. And so Keep Scotland the Brand, the campaign that I started, is in homage to what I think is one of the best food branding, not just food branding, but the Scottish branding campaigns, because Scotland is the brand. Scotland the Brand, it takes into account tourism, it takes into account textiles, it takes into account engineering, medicine. I mean, we as a nation are recognised for being a nation of innovators and about all about quality. So when the Kenyans decided that they wanted to develop a potato, because quite frankly, everything life comes back to vegetables. When the Kenyans decided that they wanted to develop a potato that was going to feed their people, be suitable for their climate, provide a source of income, they sort of looked around the world and said, well, where can we go? What can we do? And they looked at Scotland, because Scotland's reputation as a seed potato exporter is unrivaled. The Dutch are really keen to rival us, and we will find out that to our cost if there's a no-deal Brexit and tariffs on our exports go up. So Morocco, for example, would have to pay 40% more for our tatties. It's not going to happen. So the Dutch are actually really keen on there being a no-deal Brexit, because their exports are going to just go through the roof. So the Kenyans looked at Scotland's seed potatoes. And one of the reasons our seed potatoes are so good is because our weather is so rubbish. So this beautiful black soil gets really cold in the winter, lots of snow. And that means that most years, the nasty bugs and beasties that are in the soil that could promote disease are kept in check. We also have an extremely diligent science base, farm agricultural science base, that checks the soil and checks the tatties. And we have a farming base which is very professional, and they work with the scientists. So everybody knows what's happening with the potatoes. We've got tatty rogers who check the potatoes. So by the time a potato is exported to, for example, Kenya, the farmers buying it know that they are buying a disease-free quality product. And there's not a lot of places in the world that can give those guarantees in the way that Scotland does. So the Kenyans looked around and went, Scotland, we'll have you, ask me your tatties, let's get some of your scientists and your farmers out and let's get busy. So then they thought, ooh, we'd like, let's get a potato institute to go with this tatty creation. And it was there, it was the architect in Glam, the wee village that I look across onto, that got the contract for developing this Kenyan Potato Institute. Now, the reason why it matters for us to be aware of our brand, 80% of the seed potatoes exported from the United Kingdom come from Scotland. When the Tatties project in Kenya was declared a success, you go online, you will see half of the papers describe it as a great British success story. Now, I do not begrudge the tatty farmers in Kent or Jersey or Yorkshire their successes. I wish them all the very best. But if you're talking market share, if you're talking about a great British success story, there's nothing to stop an external importer looking, well, if it's all the same, we'll go down there. That's not the point. The point is, it's a Scottish success story. It's our success story. Let's get some of that back. And also for our reputation. We don't want our reputation to be sullied by substandard seed tatties, quite frankly. So when I was down at Westminster giving evidence, it was a busy week. And I was very pleased because the Scottish Farmer, which is a very august publication, they wrote a good wee bit of blurb about the event. And in that same week, they had a story about the Kenyans and the seed potatoes. And one of the journalists contacted me, said, oh, we really like what you're doing. Really interesting. Is there anything, you know, have you got any comments that you would like to make? And I went, aye, how about when the Scottish Farmer is talking about a Scottish tatty seed success story, you don't call it a great British success story in your headline. Let's do the right thing by Scottish farmers and give them their market share. And I mean, the Scottish Farmer is very fair. It's a very fair newspaper. And I think that it's just, people just get into, you know, you've got the Great British Bake Off and you've got, I don't know, Spitfires at every turn. Dame Vera Lynn will be pumping out through the supermarkets before you know it. And I think people are just sort of getting sucked into this insidious subsuming of our brand. And I think that there are many reasons why it matters that we keep Scotland the brand. It's about our food security, it's about our market share, it's about our tourism. So when I lived in Malaysia, I was lucky enough to be friends with a gentleman who ran a very upmarket supermarket. And we became friends because it was actually over Orkney cheese, which is a PGI, by the way. And I had noticed that on his shelves there was Scotch beef and there was Scotch lamb and Orkney cheese. And I went, oh, can you get smoked cheese? And he went, oh, I didn't know they did smoked cheese. And so we got chatting. And he said, where are you from? And I said, Britain. And he said, London. And I said, Scotland. And he went, oh, Braveheart. And we got talking about Orkney cheese. And now this gentleman, When I used to give my kids water, for example, I would buy, you don't want to be drinking water just out the streams of Malaysia. So I would buy reverse osmosis, big water cooler bottles of water. And they were about 12 ringgit for a bottle of water. That's about £12, I guess. No, that's a lie. It was less. It was 4 ringgit 50. I tell a lie. If I bought two, then you could get, anyway. So I would buy these big water coolers of water. And I always had several of them sitting in the house just in case. Now, to give you some context about the value of Scotland's brand, this gentleman would sell Scottish water. And he had a sign on his shelf, a wee litre of Scottish water, which was about 16 ringgit, which you're talking a big, you know, there's a big difference. And beside his water, he had a sign up, Scottish water, filtered for 10,000 years by Scots granite. And that's the power of Scotland's brand. He had a bidder who would do the online bidding for the first line-caught salmon of the season. And he would clear all this amazing, to my eyes, exotic, beautiful fish off his shelves and clear it for the first salmon. He would have it flown out overnight to have it on his shelf, or his ice, the next day. And people would come and they would sort of argue over who was going to buy. He could sell that for a lot of money because there are very well-heeled people in Kuala Lumpur. And so when you're looking at Scotch, for example, people love Scotch. And they might think about having a Scottish evening. They might sort of sit and go, well, let's put a box set of Outlander on and we'll have some salmon and we'll have some Scotch whiskey and maybe we'll go over there on holiday. And when people come for thousands of miles on holiday, that's cost them thousands of pounds to come on holiday, when they go back, they don't want to take some tat that's been made in China back with them. They're looking for Scottish produce. So when they go into shops, they're looking for local artisan products. They're looking for probably something that's a bit upmarket and probably a bit expensive to take back for their friends. They want those little knickknacks or those jewels, the items of jewellery or clothing that they can give as gifts. And they're looking for Scotland's brand. It's basic. You do the same, I'm sure. When you're on holiday, you're looking for local stuff. And so that's the point. Scotland's brand, our international reputation, it's good for business. So when on World Whiskey Day, I swear I felt faint. World Whiskey Day a couple of years ago, and I saw that it was again this year, they did the same. The Glengoyne Distillery, this beautiful picture of the vaults, and you've got a cooper sort of looking moody in the background, and big barrels, and it's all sepia and peaty, and there's a dram being pulled from a distance, and they've got written across it, whiskey is Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And I looked at it and I thought, what are they playing at? Why would you do that? But one of the reasons why I started this campaign off is because my spidey senses had been tingling and it all came together with this carrot episode. Because previously, a few weeks before that, I had been the Farmer Jonesy podcast. If you're into farming, Farmer Jonesy podcast, he's really good. And he'd had a thing about a headline which said, outrage from Scotch beef, Scotch lamb farmers. Now, it's very hard to get a farmer outraged. You might hear them grumbling all the time. But outrage, I thought, outrage. A bit perky for a farmer. So I went and had a look. And the reason that they were outraged, and the reason why I have spent a year and a half of my life pounding away at this issue is because as part of the Japan-EU CETA trade talks, which have just gone through as of December last year, we now trade with one third of the world's GDP, and the Mercosur talks, which are going on, which involve South America, I have yet to discover what's happening with that, but the point is the precedent has been set. During the Japan-Canada-EU trade talks, the reason why Scotch beef, Scotch lamb farmers were outraged was because as part of the European Union, Westminster has the care of our PGR, protected geographic indicators. Now, those are things like your Norfolk turkeys, your Arbroath smokies, your Scotch beef, your Scotch lamb, Melton Mowbray pies, a number of products, 86 products across the whole of the United Kingdom. And 17 of those are in Scotland. There's more pending, there are more applications have been put in, but 17 we have pen at the moment. And that means that if a piece of Scotch beef, that means that somebody selling beef within the European Union, or as part of this, somebody who's a signatory to the trade deal, cannot sell beef that they call Scotch beef. So the Scotch Whisky Association, they have their own PGI, they very successfully saw off a German distiller who had the word Glen in their whiskey name. So anything which implies provenance, which they cannot, if you've got a protected geographic indicator, the provenance is protected. And during the European Canada trade talks, the European Union, the continent of Europe, the nations across the continent of Europe put forward 3,000 food names for protection. The United Kingdom did not put forward one. So that means that as things stand with our current trade deal with Canada and Japan, across the European Union, the makers of prosciutto ham, feta cheese, champagne, all of those names are protected. Scotch beef, Scotch lamb are not. And I bumped into Lord Dunsey, Baron Springbank, Ian Duncan, one of the Mr. Mandel's sidekicks at the Scottish office, or the office for the Great Britain in Scotland, or whatever it's called now. And I bumped into him, and give the man his due, he was paying for petrol at Perth, at Broxton Roundabout. I saw an opportunity and I took it, and he handled it with dignity and aplomb. But so I went up to him, "Oh, Mr. Duncan, or Lord Duncan, what are you going to do to protect Scotland's PGI produce in the future?" And he kind of looked at me and he went, "Well, of course we will do everything we can to ensure that Scotland's products are protected." And I said, "Ah, but you've got previous, because in the Japan-EU-CETA trade talks, you did not submit one product name for protection." And he looked at me and he kind of sneered a little, "It's never a good idea, I don't like that." And he went, "Well, the Canadians don't like PGI." And I said, "They liked it enough to sign up for 3,000 names across the rest of Europe. Why would you not protect our names?" And he sort of muttered something, and there's only so far you could take a conversation in the crisp aisle. And I offered him the opportunity to meet in chambers later, which is yet to be taken up on. And we have, give him his credit, had a conversation on Twitter since, and he said to email him. And I have, if you're listening, I have emailed and there's nothing back yet, but you're still welcome to get in touch. So I am yet to be convinced that our food names will be protected. Now, why does that matter? Well, if we're only trading in the UK, well, why does it matter? Well, part of the reason it matters is because the US has, for many years, and Australia and others have made clear that they view Scotland's food names as something as a barrier to trade, which may well explain why the National Farmers Union policy is for the Scottish government to protect our agricultural industry, and the Westminster policy is for them to take such matters under their aegis. And this matters, this is actually a really fundamentally important point, because there was an article recently in the Press and Journal out of Aberdeen which said that the estimate is 21,500 farms could go out of business in Scotland after Brexit. And there are a number of reasons why this matters. One of them is the sustainability and viability of our communities. And it is one of the reasons why I started this campaign, is because a year and a half ago, when I looked at the evidence before me, I realised that my agricultural community could go the way of the miners. And that seriously concerns me. I am hearing from more and more farmers who are getting rid of cattle because there's literally talk about bonfires of livestock after Brexit, because people don't know if they're going to be able to sell it or not. Because, and bear with me because it does get a little complicated, and I will try and keep it less rambly than sometimes I can veer into. If the Americans get, for example, the trade deal they want, and the Australians have made clear that they're waiting for the Americans to soften us up before they come in for a bash, the Americans have given evidence, and it's recorded, you can watch it if you are so inclined, which say that they want for our food standards not to be a barrier to trade, that they view the European food standards that we currently enjoy as standard, as, what's the phrase they keep using? They want to return to a science-based approach. Now, basically, that is the same approach that they that the tobacco industry used for many years. When many people for decades were saying tobacco causes cancer, and the tobacco industry went, "Prove to us that this is so." So the European approach to food is, "Prove to me it's safe." The American approach to food is, "Prove to me it's dangerous." Now, this really, really matters, because American rates of food poisoning are 10 times higher per head of population than we have. There was a recall of meat recently, which saw I think it was 150 tons of meat, 150,000 tons of meat being recalled across 10 states because people were dying from food poisoning. And there's kind of really nasty hemorrhagic versions of E. coli happening because America does farms on an industrial scale. So you're not talking about herds of cattle wandering across the prairies. You're talking about sort of large sheds full of cattle being fed on corn, which does terrible things to a cow's digestive tract. And because of the intensity, because they're being pumped full of growth hormones, which aren't legal in the European Union because they've been shown to cause cancers, which the Americans say isn't science-based, then these cattle have rollicking diarrhea. And then they come to be slaughtered, but the slaughterhouse techniques are different than in the EU. So as part of the European Union, it is the case that you have to have a vet in place examining every animal and examining every carcass, and you have to have a distance between livestock so that it reduces... As a vegetarian, I campaign for mobile abattoirs and for better abattoirs and for more abattoirs because I think we owe it to our livestock to have a positive and as humane and end-of-life experience as is possible. And I've been in abattoirs, I've been in the abattoir up in Orkney, which was phenomenal. I was so impressed with it. And I think that's what we should, you know, the animal goes in, doesn't know what's happening, it can, dark corridor, into the light, before you know it, the cow behind it can't see what's happening, before you know it, kafunk through the head, and it's all gone. So to me, that's pretty cruelty-free. American livestock and abattoirs don't get that same. And there's a distance between the slaughterhouse. So the cow goes in, gets the chop, and viscera are removed, and it's all sort of clean, and everything's taken care of, and you've got a clean carcass at the end of it. It's all about keeping carcasses disease-free and taint-free. So basically, I don't want poop on meat, and nor should you. But that doesn't happen in America, which is the reason why they wash their livestock, like they wash, for example, chickens in chlorine. It's not, I get people sometimes going, oh, you get more chlorine in if you go to the swimming pool. I'm like, yes, but there's less poo. So the point is, that the reason chicken is chlorinated, it's not the chlorine that's the issue. It's the reason why they are chlorinating it. So what happens is you get your livestock being sort of trundled through on this very fast factory line. And in order for everything to be buy it cheap and fast and bigger and better, and you've got, I mean, it's like, just imagine Freddy Krueger making sausages, you know, I mean, that's kind of where we're at. So you're looking at viscera and contamination, and that's why food poisoning is so high. And on top of that, for example, the growth hormones. Now, in the United Kingdom, we don't do that. In the United Kingdom, we have a fairly, you know, an animal welfare approach. This what predominantly is the main feature of the slaughterhouse system. So I was concerned when a year past December, under English Votes for English laws, the English government decided to do away with animal sentience as being a part of law. So under law in Scotland, we say animals have feelings. Now, if you say that an animal has feelings under law, that means that you have to treat it in a particular way. One of those ways means that there's a vet there acting as a death doula as you shuffle off your mortal coil to make sausages. There's somebody there to make sure that you are cared for, that you're not being mistreated. So English Votes for English laws took animal sentience out of the statute book, said, nah, it's okay, animals don't have feelings. But, and here is a clever bit, Mr. Gove assured everybody that although we were taking the laws away, it didn't mean we were going to use them in ways that were going to mean that animals were less treated. So you kind of think, well, why? If you're taking them away, anyway. So one of the problems, though, is that with Brexit, if we lose the continental Europeans who bring their skills to our shores, over 90% of the vets that work in abattoirs, making sure that our livestock is well cared for, come from the continent of Europe. So one of the thoughts is, and I know this to be the case from conversations I've had with those who know, that the reason that that animal sentience has been removed is so that it would be possible then to change the rules to take vets out of the abattoirs, make things a bit cheaper, get other people in, maybe train some environmental health people up. The next day after this law was passed in England, the National Farmers Union of Scotland went chapping the door at Holyrood to say, we want animal sentience. It is a key part of animal welfare and our Farm Assured scheme. Now, one of the functions that these vets do is they guddle about in the viscera of the livestock. One of the things that the Americans, and I have watched them saying it, that they want to get rid of, it's got a fancy name, but basically it's the pig heart incision. And one of the reasons why this matters is one of the reasons why pork is a proscribed meat in many of the world's faiths. In the Middle East, there's a particular kind of vicious tapeworm that migrates around the body. And it is thought that perhaps in Leviticus and others, that's the reason why they said don't eat pork, is because they recognised there was a link between the two. That's one theory behind it. So the pig heart incision, and it happens with other livestock too, they go in, have a wee guddle about, make sure that there's not a cyst in the pig's heart and other parts of its body, to make sure that, because this is an indication that there's a tapeworm which has migrated. Now, tapeworms have got a really fascinating life cycle, but you don't want them in your bacon. Because if they're in your meat and that meat is undercooked, then that tapeworm could begin its migration around your body. And there was a poor young gentleman in India who died last month, 2 months ago, he died with cysts in his brain and his groin because he had eaten meat which had been undercooked, which had not had the benefit of our high farm-assured slaughter techniques as is prescribed, as is the case in the EU. Now, one of the things that concerns me, and one of the reasons why I spend so much of my time on this campaign, is because I live in a rural community. I don't want my community to fail. I don't want to look out on the hills and see that the farms around me have been bought up by hedge fund managers and land bankers and Russian oligarchs who fancy being a laird for this month. I don't want to see my traditional environment being bought up and suddenly fences going up around and being told that I can't walk on my land. And because things have changed and perhaps it's going to be an industrial forestry or something, that they'll come up with a reason why it's not possible to stravague over my hills. I particularly want for Scotland's brand to continue being successful, not only for our economy, not only so that we can continue to have livestock which are kept in a healthy and animal cruelty-free way, but I'm particularly exercised by the fact that currently, regardless of whether or not you can buy something fancy at the farmer's market, or Waitrose with a folderoy on top, or if you are one of those poor souls who, although you work hard at several jobs on 0 hours contracts and with few rights, you are working hard, but you cannot afford to feed your family, so you are pushed into the indignity in one of the richest countries of the world of going begging for your meal, and are presented with a box filled with own brand produce, regardless of whether you are eating a tin of own brand peas or something organic raised by hand that's got a name on it. The quality of that food, the quality of the sauce might be a little different, but the standard is the same. And the Americans, for example, have made clear that they do not want there to be any labelling on food which allows us, and I have this as a direct quote from somebody who spoke to the American ambassador. This gentleman phoned me up and he said, Ruth, forget Keep Scotland the brand. The US ambassador, who I had dinner with last night, wants us to get rid of UK the brand. They do not want us, and I quote, to discriminate. They don't want labels that would enable shoppers to discriminate against their produce. It has been made very clear there is multiple evidence out there to show that the US are determined that if they get a deal, that will include food and food standards. They want our standards to come down to theirs, and they want it to be integrated into food in such a way that you don't know what you're eating. They did that with GMO soy. When GMO soy was brought in, many people in the US said, we don't like GM, and they went, oh, you know what we're going to do? Let's just mix everything in together. So there you go, GM soy, and you can't possibly, it's like with the Scottish butter and the British butter. Oops, we couldn't possibly work out how to make it separate, although we quite frankly could. So there are many reasons why I would like you to keep Scotland the Brand and to think about this issue and to talk to people about it. It's jobs, it's our communities, it's the quality of the food on your plate, it's our health service. There are so many reasons. I would ask you please to keep Scotland the Brand. Thank you.
Indie Prime, yes, Indie Prime, on Indie Live Radio. Indie Prime.